Chapter 4. Reasons. The dance of mind and heart is a disordered reel, where they pursue each other round and round, ever searching for reasons of whatever they feel, yet lacking the love when the reasons are found. Anonymous. It was the mask engaged your mind and after set your heart to beat, not what's behind. W.B. Yeats. The mask. Love requires an object. Apart from the fact that this object must be regarded as attractive, there is little else required. What is an object, and why just this object and not another? In the first chapter, I acknowledged the existence of unusual objects of love, non-human objects, and even inanimate ones. Even devoted animal lovers may find it difficult to imagine their attachment to a favorite pet turning into erotic love. Close friends and family members usually find it almost as difficult to imagine their affection morphing into limerence. And yet, objectophiles use the familiar language of passionate love when they describe their relationship with a bridge, a bow, or the Eiffel Tower. Few of us find it possible to empathize. To be honest, you probably feel much the same about some of the couples you know. What does she see in him? I suspect that love's logic is likely much the same, whatever its objects. But where love is concerned, we seldom expect cold rationality. We have already seen that love is sometimes perceived as an affliction that strikes at random, like a sickness. My love is as a fever. But even as the love is undergone as a form of mental illness, it is also assigned reasons. In the space of four lines, in the same sonnet 147, Shakespeare both names a reason, "I had sworn thee fair," and declares it to have been insane, as madmen's are, at random from the truth. My thoughts and my discourse, as madmen's are, at random from the truth, vainly expressed. For I have sworn thee fair, and thought thee bright, who art as black as hell and dark as night. In this respect, love is much like an addiction. Even addicts act intentionally. They don't just undergo involuntary physical motions. They look for a contact, pick up a needle. They may cite the euphoria brought on by the drug as a reason to seek out the drug. Lovers, too, even when eager to represent themselves as helpless victims of passion, remain keen to tell us why they love. But do we really love for reasons? Good and bad reasons for love. It is hard to say what good reasons to love are, easier to spot bad ones. In this and other ways, reasons for love resemble reasons we give for critical judgments of beauty. Because it's expensive is a bad reason to think that a work of art is beautiful, even when it is a good reason to invest in it. That is not to say one can't be caused to think the work beautiful by the thought of its high price. An efficacious cause is not necessarily a relevant reason. Oscar Wilde built his most hilarious play around the absurdity of "because his name is Ernest" as an answer to the question, "why do you love him?" Algernon. "If my name was Algy, couldn't you love me?" Cecily, rising. "I might respect you, Ernest. I might admire your character, but I fear that I should not be able to give you my undivided attention." Being rich comes first in Benedict's list of wifely qualifications in Much Ado About Nothing. Rich she shall be, that's certain. But a good reason to marry someone is not necessarily a good reason for loving her. That someone is rich might serve as a reason to hope you might be moved by love as well. If you are planning to marry her, loving her would be highly convenient. But convenience is generally frowned upon as a reason for love. Some of Benedict's other requirements, wise, virtuous, mild, noble, of good discourse, are more plausible as reasons to love. That is because they pertain to character. At the same time, a narrow focus on character, connoting both aesthetic and moral virtues, makes a lover sound suspiciously high-minded. Attractiveness has much to do with lovability, but it tends to have little to do with virtuous character. Besides, virtues of character don't always match what people want to be loved for. There are two questions here. One, what reasons are appropriately adduced to explain or justify love? Two, what reasons would you wish to be loved for? The two may not coincide. Consider Desdemona and Othello's reasons for loving each other. According to Othello, it started with his war stories. "My story being done, she gave me for my pains a world of sighs. She loved me for the dangers I had passed, and I loved her that she did pity them." Othello, Act 1, Scene 3. His stories moved her to pity, and her sighs moved him to love. Note, incidentally, how narrowly gender-specific these responses are. It would be difficult to imagine them switching. We shall come back to the implications of gender in Reasons for Love, but for now, let us ask about stories and their role as reasons for love. Do we all, like Othello, want to be loved for the stories we tell, both to ourselves and others? The stories you tell may well have much to do with your hopes of being loved, but that doesn't mean they have to be true. Many relationships, like most nations, rest on a founding lie. Come to think of it, "I pity him" is hardly plausible as a justification for "I love him," and "she pitied me" is not much of a reason to love her. Our nose for phony reasons may lead us to suspect Othello isn't getting it quite right. Straight shooter though he was, he can't have resisted embellishing the stories that so gratifyingly gripped his audience. As for the emotions he aroused in Desdemona, they were surely not limited to pity. In the first flush of a love affair, eager as you are to make a good impression, you too, dear listener, may have exaggerated the pains you have endured and the dangers you have passed, or you may have sighed just a little more pitifully than strictly necessary. Reasons can go wrong in various ways. If there is something wrong with the claim to love someone because she is rich, for example, this may not be because it reflects badly on your character. Neither is it because her wealth couldn't cause your love. It could also provide reasons for trying to find reasons to love, but it is simply unintelligible as a reason for love, as we understand that word. That puts a lot of weight on the phrase, as we understand it. It might be otherwise in some other time and place. But in a culture where riches justify love, as opposed to making people pretend to love or wish they loved, the concept would not be understood as I understand it. Some may doubtless disagree, but that simply illustrates the fact that what is or is not fully intelligible as a reason to love partly defines the very concept of love. What of the beloved's point of view? Here, gender becomes important. A woman might care intensely about not being loved for her beauty. "May she be granted beauty," wrote Yeats in his Prayer for My Daughter, "and yet not beauty to make a stranger's eye distraught, or hers before a looking glass. For such being made beautiful overmuch, consider beauty a sufficient end." A poignant evocation of the difficulty of transcending physical appearance is in Peter Carey's story, The Chance. The protagonist's beautiful lover is a member of a group of fanatical egalitarians. Despite his pleas, she insists on submitting to a random body reassignment. When she emerges, now ugly, he finds himself unable to continue loving her. How reasons work. We talk of reasons both for what we do and for what we feel. But reasons may work rather differently in the two cases. A reason to do something is typically adduced in support of a decision to act. By contrast, we seldom deliberate about what to feel. Giving a reason for a feeling is more often backward-looking. It singles out something that appears to be its cause. Sometimes, however, a reason is summoned to induce a feeling. She helped you with your move, so you ought to feel grateful. Alas, rehearsing reasons is often entirely ineffectual. I agree that I should feel grateful or angry or ashamed, but in fact, I feel nothing at all. Although love is a lot more than an emotion, it is marked by characteristic feelings which cannot be summoned at will. For one who feels strongly that she has reason to love, failing to love can be agonizing. Conversely, it can be embarrassing or inconvenient to have loving feelings when you think you have reason not to. That happens too, although reasons not to love tend to be more persuasive than reasons to love. The discovery that your lover is a psychopathic murderer or has vulgar tastes in music are more likely to snuff out love than his supposed virtues were to ignite it in the first place. In sum, the role of reasons for love is confusing. To shed some light on it, it will help to consider the question from three points of view: the lover, an objective observer, and the beloved. As a lover, the reasons for your love must often amount to the thoughts and images you take most pleasure in when calling your beloved to mind. You think of those mental snapshots as illustrating the qualities or moments that caused and now sustain your love, and you usually feel that those causes offer ample justification for your feelings. She is so beautiful, so lively, so witty, and oh, the way she laughs, especially at my jokes. But are those really reasons? If they are, they should move anyone to love, for it is the very essence of reason to be universally applicable. A reason for you is a reason for anyone. Anyone in the same circumstances, that is. The qualifier is essential, but it weakens the force of the universality requirement, for circumstances are never the same. That, however, does not deprive the requirement of all its power. Circumstances only need to be the same in relevant respects. That sets up a challenge. If you respond differently from me, each of us owes an account of some relevant difference between our two cases. An outside observer may detect causes of love that will always remain obscure to the lover. Such cases might be made manifest by a novelist, or suspected by a psychoanalyst, or even demonstrated by an experimental psychologist. Any of those outside observers may be able to see that the lover's own proffered reasons are mere rationalizations. What of the point of view of the beloved? A common answer to the question of why you would like to be loved is, "I want to be loved for who I am." That could be glossed in two ways. It could mean that I want to be loved for myself unconditionally. That would imply that your lover's attitude will not change even if you change. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds. Shakespeare, Sonnet 116. Alternatively, for myself can refer to the qualities I think most essential to my identity. In that case, it won't necessarily follow that love will remain constant. That will depend on whether those essential qualities are still there. On that important point, there might be disagreement between your lover and an objective observer who regards your self-image as self-deceptive. Whose authority counts for most in deciding what is most essential about you? To shed light on this question, we need to know two facts about our use of the word love. The first is that there are two ways of thinking of a person's identity, as just that person, whatever she may be like, or as a person of a certain kind, macho cad, witty and lively. The second fact is that what we regard as an appropriate reason for love contributes to our understanding of the nature of love. Explaining the significance of these two facts is going to be a little intricate and will require me to introduce some philosophical jargon, so fasten your seatbelts. If you bear with me, we should be able to gain some clarity. Love, like belief, desire, and emotions such as anger and fear, is an intentional state. That's jargon term number one. An intentional state is about something. That something may or may not exist, you can have beliefs or emotions about unicorns as well as real people. I will refer to intentional states, including love, as attitudes. Attitudes can have different sorts of objects. Belief and desire are typically about states of affairs or propositions, commonly expressed in clauses beginning with that. Those clauses provide the propositional objects of the attitudes. That's jargon term number two. Some attitudes, such as fear or love, have propositional objects. I fear that my boss will find out I sleep on the job. I love that she wears Prada. But they can also have a direct object. I fear my boss. I love Zuleika. The boss or partner is the target of the intentional state. That's jargon term number three. An attitude can be more or less appropriate to its target. Responding with awe to the sight of the Grand Canyon is appropriate. Feeling awe at the contemplation of a toothpick, not so much. An attitude is appropriate if the point of it is fulfilled. The point of belief, for example, is truth. That means that belief is an appropriate attitude to any true proposition and no false one. If asked why you believe something, you can say, because it's true. It isn't informative, but it invokes the point of believing. Similarly, because it's good is a trivially correct answer to why do you desire it. The point of desire is to pursue something good. In the same way, because it's dangerous answers why are you afraid of it. In addition, the presence of the dangerous animal will be the cause of your fear, and so on for other attitudes. Which of the target's characteristics is responsible for arousing your attitude? Call this the target's focal property, or more simply, focus. That is our last jargon term. The target can be merely imaginary. One can be in awe of a non-existent god. And the focus can be illusory. One can be afraid of something that isn't actually dangerous. In that case, the cause is not in the target or focus, but in yourself. Your attitude is real enough, but it is unjustified because it was not caused by a target in virtue of its focal property. For an attitude to be appropriate, the focal property of the target must match the point of the attitude. This is all a bit complicated, but its application to examples should make clear how we judge an attitude to be appropriate or inappropriate. Suppose you are frightened of a dog because it is rabid. The dog is the target, and its disease the focus of your fear. But perhaps it is not rabid, and your fear is due to a phobia originating in an unfortunate past encounter. In that case, the dog is still the target of your fear, but it lacks the focal property to match the point of fear. Hence, your fear is not warranted. A similar story might be told about anger. Its point is to respond to deliberate insult or injury. So, anger is warranted if it was triggered by such an insult, but not if it results from irritability caused by too much coffee. What of the attitude called love? To say love targets what is lovable is uninformative, but correct. According to the symposium, love is the attitude specifically appropriate to beauty. And beauty has also been thought causally responsible for stirring love, just as the dog's rabies may have caused fear. If you love a person, she is the target of your love and implicated in causing it. So, Romeo loves Juliet, the target, because she is fair, the focal property, which underpins her being lovable, the point, and is a cause of Romeo's feelings. Does her being fair really warrant and cause his love? Many other girls are fair, and maybe Romeo is the only one to think Juliet fair. The key causal factor might turn out to be Juliet's resemblance to Romeo's mother, or some love potion poured into his drink, or some purely reflexive attraction due to pheromones of which no one is aware at all. All this is summarized in Table 1. Table 1. A Taxonomy of Objects. Attitude, fear. Point, dangerousness. Target, dog. Focus, fierceness, rabies. Causal efficacy, perception of focal property, or phobia, etc. Attitude, anger. Point, deliberate injury. Target, person. Focus, insulting character. Causal efficacy, perception of insult, or too much coffee, etc. Attitude, love. Point, lovability. Target, person. Focus, fair, gentle. Causal efficacy, fair, gentle, etc. Or transference, or unconscious memory, pheromones, etc. Here, finally, is how the two facts about love noted earlier can help us to understand what went wrong with Diotima's bizarre ladder of love. One fact was that our conception of what love is and what, if anything, warrants or justifies love is bound up with the point of it, which is what it takes for someone to be lovable. Whether we truly love for reasons depends on whether there is, in that sense, a point to love. The other fact was that there is a crucial difference between the target and the focus of any attitude. The ladder of love was arrived at by failing to make these distinctions. The beautiful boy is the target, and his beauty is the focus of the lover's attention. That focus is an appropriate reason for love, insofar as beauty is the point of love. By confounding all three, Diotima erects beauty as the target of love, to the detriment of the boy who was its original target. On the intermediate rung in the ladder, you are required to extend your love to all equally beautiful boys. Does that really follow from the universality of reasons? If you want to reject this polyamorous conclusion as absurd, you need to find a relevant difference between the original boy and all the others. Perhaps that difference lies in the boy's qualities. Or maybe the only crucial difference is just that one boy got there first. If so, you will have to retreat from the claim that love is justified by reasons. Mere priority may explain the presence of love, but it can hardly count as a reason for love. Two more puzzles diagnosed. The most constant wife in Greek mythology was Alcmene, wife of Amphitryon. So faithful was she that Zeus was unable to seduce her in any of the seduction disguises, swan, bull, or shower of gold, that had worked with other mortal targets of his lust. His last resort was to show up as her husband. As a god, he could assume all of Amphitryon's qualities. The man who made love to Alcmene that night was indistinguishable from Amphitryon in all the focal properties for which she loved him. So why would she mind? Of course, history doesn't say whether she did mind, but in analogous cases that have recently come before the courts, women have been known to win a rape conviction when the wrong twin took advantage of dim light. Despite possessing the right focal properties, Zeus was not the target of Alcmene's love, so she too was raped, despite her ostensible consent. More puzzling is the case of Roxanne in Edmond Rostand's play Cyrano de Bergerac. Roxanne thinks she loves Christian, not just because he is handsome and brave, but because, as she falsely believes, he is the author of the witty and poetic words that are actually Cyrano's. Cyrano, too, loves Roxanne, but his disfiguring nose forbids him any hope of requital. Years later, long after Christian has been killed in war, Roxanne insists she would love Christian for his poetic wit, even if he were ugly. When the truth finally transpires, should we say Roxanne really loved Cyrano all along? Here the difficulty is that there are two potential targets and two sets of focal properties. Cyrano's wit was the focus and a cause of her love, but Christian's looks and bravery contributed as well. It was Christian whom Roxanne kissed and married and mourned, even though he lacked the focal properties in which she thought her love was grounded. It was now too late to change the target of her love, even though it was picked on false pretenses. Maybe she would have loved Cyrano, though she could be wrong about that, but as things stand, she loved Christian. The lesson of these cases is that the target of love is a particular individual, not just whoever happens to have the right qualities. Even lacking the right qualities altogether may not matter. Once the target is picked, only that actual individual counts as relevantly similar. Targets of love are non-fungible. An object such as a 5-pound note is fungible when any other of equivalent value, any set of notes adding up to 5 pounds, is acceptable as a replacement. In many human relationships, including some sexual relations, persons are to some extent replaceable, insofar as they fulfill a certain role for the participants. Think, for example, of a sensible person arranging a marriage or advertising for a mail-order spouse. There will be a list of requirements exchanged. Those requirements may be stringent, but in principle, any number of people could meet them. The target of love, by contrast, is not a kind of person, however elaborately specified. It is a particular individual whom no other could replace. Only once a target exists can she be the target of love. It wouldn't make sense to say, "I'm in love, but I don't know with whom." Once fixed, the target of love is non-fungible. Widows and widowers remarry and love again, but that doesn't mean that their first love was replaced by an equivalent love. It may merely have been displaced by a different one. You may love several people, at once or in succession, but each one is irreplaceable. None of that leaves us any further ahead with the question of what is it that fixes the target of love in the first place? Could you, after all, be wrong about the target of your love? Sigmund Freud thought so. Several of his patients claimed to fall in love with him. Since his technique consisted in sitting, mostly in silence, out of the patient's sight, Freud reasoned that this love couldn't really be meant for him. He surmised that it was an illusion, a response originally directed at some important real figure in the patient's early life, now targeted at the analyst by a process of transference. He went on to wonder whether all love might really be transference from some infantile attachment. This idea has become a popular cliché. Every man marries his mother, every woman marries her father. That's why second spouses often look like the first. Transference is only one of many causal influences that do not figure as reasons in the lover's consciousness. There are undoubtedly many others. Your genes, together with a host of forgotten episodes, have conditioned the ranges of things you notice, or want, or like, or can find yourself in that telling phrase, falling in love with. A political dimension. Some puzzles are dispelled by distinguishing kinds of objects, but anxieties about the appropriate focus of love remain and can be of intense personal and even political concern. We have seen that although love is said to be doubly blind, both to the beloved's faults and to the charms of others, it has also been described as the most vivid apprehension of the beloved. That suggests that the lover's attitude should focus on the whole person in all her complex singularity. A skeptical psychologist might doubt whether this is possible. Musicians of genius, like Mozart, are said to apprehend the whole of a symphony in a single act of consciousness. But even Mozart could not have attended to all its parts in detail at the same time. To apprehend a symphony, let alone a person, as a whole, would imply that the smallest change of detail would be detected. But a host of convincing experiments demonstrate that observers, even when watching closely, fail to notice important changes in the scene before them. It is reasonable to infer that the feeling you have of seeing someone as a whole, however intense, is not necessarily veridical. Even Romeo and Juliet, although blinded by one another's dazzling light to the enmity of their tribes, must have seen each other through the prism of their social setting. In most times and places, gender roles have been especially constricting for women. Where corsets and foot binding did not literally deform women's bodies, social norms metaphorically crippled the personalities of all but the most heroically eccentric. Roles available to women were defined essentially by their relations to men as lover, wife, mother, or whore. You, dear listener, may have good reason to think this doesn't concern you. If you are a man, you have long understood the infantilism of macho posturing, and you view women as equals. If you are a woman, you have avoided the dependency entailed by traditional gender roles. Not all couples, however, will be as free as you are from heterosexist prejudice. Individual effort cannot entirely elude the power of stereotypes. What might it mean for Romeo to achieve a lucid vision of Juliet as she is? If Romeo could not be aware of all her qualities at once, he has no option but to focus on some subset of her qualities crucial to her identity. But how are those picked out? Is she the best authority on her own unique individuality? A woman may herself be prey to a conventional view of what she should be as a woman, derived from a more or less constraining patriarchal environment. It has been reported that 41% of British women would prefer to have big breasts rather than a high IQ. Sexist environments damage women's conception of their own potential. To love her for herself might require her lover to see beyond her own limited ambition. But when her lover claims to see her more clearly than she sees herself, in his very effort to be most attentive to a best self she herself does not own, must he not again risk failing to respect her autonomy? There is no simple or general answer to the question of who is the authority on one's authentic self. Fixing love's target. At the opposite extreme from perfect clarity of vision, the most pessimistic view about the causality of love is that the lover has made it all up. Some writers on love have settled for a more benign version of that hypothesis. Your beloved is indeed unique, it has been said, because you have bestowed on him the characteristics that make him lovable. You simply decree that the beloved's focal properties match the point of love. The problem with this strategy is that it seems to require you to believe something at will. What the subjectivist bestowal view proposes, however, is more subtle than simply pretending that your beloved is flawless. Rather, it consists in valuing traits that are neutral in themselves. Two psychological mechanisms might account for such bestowal. First, mere acquaintance in itself tends to induce liking. Other things being equal, familiarity should make the heart grow fonder. When it fails, blame all the other things that are not equal. The second psychological factor is Pavlovian associative learning. Suppose you have become attracted to Zuleika and can give a plausible list of her attractive properties, all of which fit the point of love as you understand it. That doesn't mean you love her. It might, however, encourage you to seek her company. And now, Zuleika's carrot hair, by association, may come to trigger the positive feelings her attractiveness originally stirred. If carrot hair did nothing for you before, you will seem to have gratuitously bestowed on Zuleika the lovability of carrot hair. That may now be, for you, a reason for love in the attenuated sense of being one of the features you take pleasure in when you think of Zuleika. As an account of reasons for love, the bestowal theory is not satisfying. It does nothing to explain why some bestowals might be more worthy than others. When do we have good reasons to bestow value on a target's focal properties? The answer could lie in an entirely different conception of the reasons for love, one that embraces, rather than avoids, the universality of reasons. The very feature of reasons that seemed the most difficult to accommodate to the vagaries of love. In a move reminiscent of Plato's theory that every lover is really after the same beauty, the philosopher David Velleman has argued that the motivating focal property of the beloved is always the same. It is none other than her autonomous rational will, which, according to Immanuel Kant, is the essential core of every person. This view requires us to distinguish true love not only from lust, but from those individual quirks in both lover and beloved that produce a rush of tenderness towards some and leave you indifferent to others. Since we are all the same in our core rational self, it hardly seems to matter whom one loves. And from the point of view of the beloved, this view has the advantage that you will never be loved for the wrong reasons. Superficial, unworthy, or trivial characteristics, such as your yellow hair, are not part of that autonomous, rational self which is most deeply you. Unfortunately, being loved for your essential, rational self is unlikely to make you feel singled out. Velleman is at pains to point out that one simply doesn't have the time to extend one's Kantian love, like Plato's, to every boy or girl in sight. The target of your love is not distinguished by unique qualities. She is just the person who happened to be the first applicant for one of the limited slots available on the dance card of your love life. In some sense, that is probably true. Our loves are as accidental as the rest of life, but this is unlikely to be comforting for the beloved who wants to feel special, and it makes for an uncommonly feeble defense of the claim that we love for reasons. Furthermore, the very universality that this proposal buys at such a high cost is unattainable. Velleman's purified notion of love refers to an enhanced attitude of respect, directed at some rational beings among all those rational beings that are intrinsically worthy of such respect. It targets the rational core common to every human. That's a pretty sophisticated attitude. We can hardly expect an infant, or someone who is severely mentally handicapped, to respond with respect, or any other specific attitude, to another's core rational being. Yet, presumably, infants, and mentally challenged people too, can love. Indeed, there is reason to believe that the psychological origin of love lies precisely in the attachment acquired by normal humans in infancy. We need a different approach to the problem of what makes a person the target of love. Instead of stressing the universality of reasons, an altogether different strategy involves stretching the notion of a property. In an extended sense, perhaps each person is unique in virtue of a unique property. There are two ways to do this, both somewhat tricky. The first is to posit that being oneself is itself a property, called ipsiety. The word is derived from ipse, the Latin word for himself. Only Socrates is Socrates. Only you are you. On this view, each person is essentially different from every other, not in virtue of any set of properties, but in being just this person and no other. Like the Kantian core, this property is universal, but unlike the rational self, which is the same in everyone, each ipsiety is irreducibly different. Being just this irreducible self is the focal property that uniquely identifies the target of love. Like Velleman's view, the idea that ipsiety explains the selection of the loved one is intellectually heroic but comically absurd. Just between you and me, dear listener, that is often the case with clever philosophers' ideas. For to say that your ipsiety differs from mine says nothing about what the difference amounts to. Historicity. The second proposal for tweaking the idea of a property in an unexpected way is more promising. Some feminists have disparaged love as a cruel hoax because no single lover has the strength to overcome the tendency to objectify women, making their desirability contingent on their playing traditional and often submissive roles. Yet, if lovers make a concerted effort to construct a novel story based on their authentic individuality, they may stand a chance of overcoming those gender stereotypes. Instead of fixed, essential identities that each must learn to decode in the other, there will be a forging of a unique relationship of which each is a part. That, in fact, might be the elusive, longed-for union, which could turn out to be made of entirely pragmatic and quotidian engagements. When lovers begin to do this, they embark on the construction of a robust approach to lovers' uniqueness. They are grounding that uniqueness in their joint history. That is the historicity of love. Like the ipsiety approach, this presupposes that lover and beloved are particular individuals that endure through time. But ipsiety was merely a made-to-measure, artificial property. Historicity, by contrast, is based on the actual uniqueness of every particular's path through space-time. The intertwining of two or more such paths constitutes the bond of love, as both its cause and its result. It causes the bond by providing shared memories, and it results from it because it motivates further shared projects. Instead of a crucial property that identifies each lover, there is a dynamic process involving both. It is unique because it is practically, though not logically, impossible that a person's life should contain a sequence of events shared with A which exactly matches the sequence of events she shared with B. Something in the fine structure of their intertwined braids is bound to differentiate the two strands. Even if they were indistinguishable from an external point of view, their impact on the partners could not be the same, since for each, but not for both, one must have preceded the other. Historicity helps to explain why it matters that Alcmene's love targeted Amphitryon. Although Zeus adopted all the present attributes of Amphitryon for that one night, he shares neither the couple's past memories nor their future projects. We can also see why, in the case of Cyrano, the importance of wit and poetry in charming Roxanne cannot overcome the history she has shared with Christian. Even though she now has a much longer history with Cyrano, it is not the same history. It is too late now for her love to switch targets. Historicity generates uniqueness in three different ways. First, only the two of you have this particular history of activity shared, tribulations endured, ideas exchanged, all of which can foster the idea to continue the story. Second, engagement in shared projects necessarily excludes those not sharing in them. Third, and closest to the metaphor evoked by the Aristophanic myth, there is an elusive way that, given innate tastes and preferences, memories and associations, each happens to find attractive just these quirks of personality, these patterns of strength and vulnerability, in which the beloved differs from all others. The dynamics at these three levels makes all the difference. For if the property that constitutes the motivating focus of love is an interactive process rather than a perceived property of the beloved, we can no longer think of it as needing to be preserved from alteration so that love may persist. Indeed, it is the process of perpetual change that will preserve the continuity of love. Or may do, if anything does. For dynamic interaction may lead to love's dissolution as well as its preservation. To explain the non-fungibility of the beloved is not to guarantee its continuity. A richly developed variant of the idea of historicity has been defended by philosopher Niko Kolodny. On his view, love has not one target, but two. He calls these foci, but I will stay with my terminology to avoid confusion. The first is the beloved. The second is the relationship. On his view, the existence of the relationship is itself a reason for love. In the terms I have introduced, we could speak of the nature of the relationship as forming the focal properties that define the kind of love it is. The role of historicity is not confined to erotic love. It could also be love of a parent, or a daughter, or a friend. In each case, Kolodny suggests, there is more to the power of a relationship than the unique causal history it embodies. A relationship is not just a sequence of facts and events. It is also a normative framework. As such, it engenders not merely reasons for love, but the duty to love in the way appropriate to the relationship in question. Relationships, on this view, engender duties of love. The Countess of Champagne might have protested that such duties can require behavior, but not sentiment. However, we have seen reason to deem her simplistic on this point. The comparison with belief uncovered ways to take responsibility for what we cannot simply do at will. In believing, we can attend to evidence and take care not to jump to conclusions. In love, behavior that is expressive of love can be willed, even when the feeling cannot be summoned. Such behavior, in turn, is likely to foster loving feelings. In the mutual engagement of a relationship, such as that encouraged by advocates of historicity, many things we do can affect how we feel. Love is likely to be enhanced by the cultivation of habits of care and attention, by mutual openness to vulnerability, and by engagement in common projects and play. All these involve behavior that can be chosen, if not always achieved. And while that behavior is motivated by love, it actually feeds back to strengthen love. Note that such dynamic engagement in a relationship makes no presumption of either exclusiveness or constancy. Things can change even while they remain things between us, and the things that are between you and me are not necessarily incompatible with the existence of something that is between you and another. The metaphor is no longer of an enduring core self, but of one or more long ropes made of overlapping strands, none of which need go the whole length of the rope. But does all that provide reasons? Both lover and beloved may feel that it does. I love him because he is attentive, open, engaged. We share so many adventures. Our love will grow as we both grow together. Such reasons purport to draw on deep natural facts about the sorts of relationships most suited to our human nature. but precisely for that reason, they are steeped in ideology. The ties of love that follow from a given relationship are culturally variable. This is most clearly seen in the rules governing incest. For biologists, kinship is about proportions of genes shared. For anthropologists, it is constructed by social conventions, the power of which derives in great part from the myth of their natural origin. Proximity in childhood can either promote or deter erotic or other forms of love. In cultures close to ours, proximity works fairly reliably to inhibit both sexual attraction and limerence, regardless of whether the children brought up together are biologically related. Elsewhere, as in some cultures of ancient Egypt and Persia, love and marriage between siblings seem to have been encouraged. The historicity of love is broader than the lover's history. It comprises not only their private entanglement, but also the arbitrary constraints dictated by historically variable norms, gender roles, and traditional taboos. For a relationship to exist, it must have started. And if we ask how that happened, we can no longer appeal to historicity. If love is historical, then by definition, there is no love at first sight. Yet such a phenomenon is widely reported. Love at first sight can't have reasons, but it can have causes. Supposed reasons come later, as rationalizations. The real causes, whether they lie in pheromones, old associations, or anything else, are inaccessible to consciousness. Titania offers the best model for the sudden onset of love in A Midsummer Night's Dream. A chemically dependent determinism attends every birth and the beginning of limerence. The difference is that the love spell cast by family ties and the promises that rashly flood the limerent lover's mind are not so easily reversed as Oberon's spell. Love and beauty again. At the beginning of this chapter, I briefly compared good and bad reasons for love to good and bad reasons for judgments of beauty. Apart from the long-standing inclusion of beauty in lovability, the two have something in common. Even good reasons are never good enough. In praising a painting, a critic might adduce this ardent color, or that graceful line, or the balance of a composition. But it will always be possible to find another painting that shares that feature and yet fails to be good. If reasons are, by definition, universal, how can one really speak of such features as affording reasons? The problem was solved by the philosopher of art Arnold Eisenberg, a rare and notable event when a philosopher actually solves a problem. To reconcile the universality of reasons with the impossibility of providing necessary and sufficient reasons for aesthetic judgments, Eisenberg showed that we need only notice that the language of reasons works differently here. In other domains, in science or mathematics or even politics, a reason identifies a feature sufficient to constitute good grounds for the conclusion. In art criticism, by contrast, allusions to some feature are not meant to describe a property sufficient to make something beautiful. Instead, they are meant to guide the viewer's attention in such a way as to get her to see the picture as the speaker sees it. If this succeeds, the viewer will have access to the universalizable reason for the picture's beauty. The blue squiggle or line of beauty is not what makes a picture beautiful, but if you attend to it, you will see why the whole picture's looking like this is what makes it beautiful. Something similar is true of so-called reasons for love. Since the historical solution is essentially relational, there is no serious prospect of getting another to see your beloved as you do. For the individuals involved, such historically complex reasons come to much the same as the form of ipsiety I rejected as trivial. And although such reasons may involve morally or aesthetically valuable qualities, that is of no use in arguing about them, for those properties can only be apprehended in the holistic way described, which none but the principles can access. I conclude that love does not derive from reason, virtue, or Kantian core rationality. It is largely the offspring of chance. In proximity, order of acquaintance, pheromone compatibility, genetic influences, and accidents of taste, transference, and habit. And it is none the worse for that.